Hi, podcast listeners. It's Doug Fabrizio. Last month, the Radio West Book Club tried something different. We read a selection of short stories by the writer Shirley Jackson. Jackson's work is enjoying something of a renaissance right now. Some of you might be familiar with the Netflix show The Haunting of Hill House. That is based on her gothic horror novel. But Jackson also wrote popular humorous essays about her life as a mother of four children. She also wrote a lot of short stories. So we all read together probably her most famous story called The Lottery. This is about this shocking tradition of a small New England town. And even though it was published back in 1948, it still holds the distinction as being the most controversial story The New Yorker has ever published. We also read An Ordinary Day with Peanuts and Charles. Both of those have Jackson's signature twist endings. And because it was a long month, we also ended up with two non-Jackson stories, The Ones Who Walk Away from O'Malis by Ursula Le Guin and N.K. Jemisin's The Ones Who Stay and Fight. We met recently as a group to talk about Shirley Jackson and her work. Leading the conversation was our executive producer, Christy Miners, with Slate's book and cultural columnist Laura Miller as our special guest. Laura is the author of The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. And Laura started off the conversation.
Okay, well, I mean, one interesting thing about Shirley Jackson that people don't realize is that she was born and spent the first 18 years of her life in California, in basically San Mateo, which is in what we would now call Silicon Valley. And she was the child of a sort of, I mean, it's a prosperous suburb, basically. And her mother was a kind of a, somewhere between a socialite and a wannabe socialite. You know, she was like a lady who lunched. And Shirley never quite lived up to her mother's idea of what a lady should be. And then she went off to college at the university, State University at Rochester. I can't remember exactly what the name of the university was, but the one in Rochester, New York. And that is where she met Stanley Edgar Hyman, who became her husband. And the famous story is that she published a short story in one of the student publications, and Stanley read it and said, "I'm going to marry the woman who wrote that," even though they had never met. And that's what he did. And so they lived in New York for a little while, which you can kind of guess from Ordinary Day with Peanuts, that is the, you know, they lived in somewhere in the village. And then Stanley, who was a literary critic, he wrote for The New Yorker and a bunch of other publications. He got a job at Bennington College in Vermont, and they moved up there. And they lived in a couple of sort of great big houses up there, and they had four children. And that is where she wrote a lot of the stories that she's best known for, like The Lottery and Haunting of Hill House. And it was not a total, she didn't totally love it there, although I think there were things she liked about it. And then she died quite young, in her 40s. She was an unhealthy person. There's a lot of disputes about what might have sort of hastened her death. That a friend of mine named Ruth Franklin, who wrote the most recently published biography of Jackson, kind of had to struggle a little bit with her children, a couple of whom I've met, just talking about Shirley and Stanley's use of amphetamines, which was very common in writers in the 60s, like surprisingly common. And you know, it was just like coffee, but more. And you know how writers are about coffee. So so it seems likely that like she had a heart attack, and it seems likely that contributed to it. But she, you know, she wrote both short novels and short stories that are like the ones that you've read recently. They have this kind of dark kind of sardonic quality, but then she also made a lot of money writing humorous first-person essays about her family life for women's magazines. And they're really great. They're kind of like a much sharper, smarter Irma Bombeck kind of thing. They're such a delight to read, and there's two collections of those if you're interested. So she's interesting because her work has both this very comic, fun, sort of relatable vein, and then it has this very weird, dark, kind of morbid, and maybe even a little bit like crazy side. I mean, insanity is a very common theme in her fiction. So she was an interesting, you know, mix of those two things.
I want to come back to Stanley because he seems to figure very largely both not only, of course, obviously in her life, but also seems to come up in her work in various ways, whether named or unnamed. Liz in our group had a question that she had ponied up that I think is a good jumping off place as we're talking about Shirley Jackson's style is American Gothic. First of all, we're wondering what are the defining characteristics of American Gothic? And is that a genre that fits Shirley Jackson?
I don't know what that means. It seems to me like there's regional Gothic modes, so that there's obviously Southern Gothic. And then I just think that even though she wasn't a native New Englander, her work fits pretty well in with the sort of New England Gothic that would be like H.P. Lovecraft or Stephen King, not in the style or the content so much as the mood.
What genre did her work fit in? I mean, she's called a horror writer in some ways, her spookier stuff. Does that fit? Or is she a little genre undefined in some ways?
Yeah, I don't think it really fits given what the horror genre has become over the years. Like, they're not that horrifying. Sometimes they're scary. I mean, or disturbing, like I Capture the Castle. Sorry, We Have Always Lived in the Castle. I always do that. And The Haunting of Hill House are both really disturbing novels. And those are generally considered to be her two best works of fiction. And they're, you know, about people going crazy and killing people, but they're not gruesome or full of like a lot of, they don't have the rhythm of what we would associate with horror. They're like a kind of a psychological horror, like The Turn of the Screw or along those lines. Even more, they're even sort of less horror than maybe Poe, I would say. Although I think Poe is also in that sort of vaguely, even though he was not from New England either, in that sort of vaguely New Englandish Gothic mode. I think she published in all kinds of publications. I don't think that she was really relegated so much to a genre when she was alive, except for the sort of family essays that she wrote, which were very clearly in a particular commercial genre of the time that was pretty big. There were a lot of books like that, Cheaper by the Dozen, The Egg and I, these sort of humorous memoirs of family life. That was like a big thing in the mid-20th century. And so I think she was known for that, but like when she was writing for the New Yorker, I think they were just seen as short stories.
Well, The Lottery, when we read that, there was a lot of discussion because there is an element of horror to it. It is certainly unsettling.
Yeah, but I think that horror as a genre didn't really exist when she was writing. It's really more a product of the 70s, and so that the idea of horror that we have now. So it's really, you know, a lot of the issues of categorizing her work or judging the tone of it, you know, what she was trying to do, like there's clearly certain things that she does with tone where the characters are talking in a way where they're making fun of some other kind of conventional way that literary characters talk. But that we're not familiar with anymore because we don't read the cheesy bestsellers of, you know, the 1950s anymore. And so, you know, it's hard to put yourself in the historical place that she was in. Like, she was not, she didn't write Peyton Place. She wasn't a big best-selling author, but some of her books sold quite well and were considered successful. And I think people saw The Haunting of Hill House as a ghost story, but lots of literary writers wrote ghost stories, like Henry James. He wrote a lot of them. I just don't think that the categories that we use now, especially in terms of genre content, were always applicable at the time that she was working.
Well, let's talk a little bit about The Lottery, because one of the things after we read this, I realized that this was the most controversial. In fact, it probably still may be the most controversial story that The New Yorker has published. They received just tons of letters about this. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's not like they're known for really controversial stories. They're known for very sort of conventionally literary short stories. They were then and they are now, although people, short stories were much more of an entertainment thing before television was so prevalent. You got paid more for them. Every magazine ran them. People would write for, like, Faulkner published in Mademoiselle at some point. So it's just the literary world was kind of different then. But yes, she has a really hilarious essay that is anthologized in the Come Along With Me collection that I wrote the introduction to for the Penguin Modern Classics. And it's a mixture of fiction and nonfiction. And it's just a lot of stuff that hadn't been published before. And so this essay is about the reception of The Lottery. And so she talks about all the letters that she got and how, you know, they're funny because they're really like, they're like internet comment sections or like rando Twitter replies that people get. You know, it's just like this sort of weird id of America that just comes float, you know, shooting at you like, you know, bullets, you know, and you're just like, whoa, you know, and she clearly kind of enjoyed it because it fulfilled some of her, I use the word dark so much, but her sort of her dark view of human nature or her sort of skepticism about human goodness. You know, she has this joke that some people wrote to say this and some people wrote to say that and some people wrote to say, where do these ceremonies take place and can they go and see one? That kind of thing. And it's a fun essay. But yeah, it got just so much mail.
Do we know the backstory of The Lottery at all? Was she inspired by anything particular as that came about?
Well, you know, that she has a story about walking back from either the post office or the grocery store, I can't remember, and getting the idea for it, you know, like pushing a stroller or something. But I think other people feel like that story might not be completely legit because it's the kind of story that she would like to tell. Like, I'm just a mom pushing a stroller and then I have this idea for this really horrible story. And isn't that just the way people are, you know, like this nice looking small town mom with her kids is thinking up these horrible scenarios. She did say at a certain point, someone asked her what it was about and she said anti-Semitism. And she was married to a Jewish man in a small town in Vermont. And I think she felt that Stanley had a community at the university that she didn't feel like she completely meshed with. And she didn't really like being a faculty wife. And yet the people in the town, they're small town New Englanders and they just did not see her as, you know, a person who fit in their group. I mean, she has another story that's so funny. Now that I live in a town, a small town in Maine on the coast where there are people who have houses here, but they're only here in the summer and they're called summer people here. She has a story called Summer People about some summer people who stay past the summer and how, like, the whole town, like, there's just this sense that the whole town is like closing in on them for this transgression. And it's funny because there's definitely such a social divide here between the summer people and the people who are year round. And so she would take something like that, like the feeling of being excluded or of, and I'm I don't doubt she heard anti-Semitic things from the people in Bennington. And then she would just ratchet it up into some, you know, higher level of menace.
Well, that's something that we talked about, at least in two of the stories that we read, Ordinary Day with Peanuts and The Lottery. There, it's the mundane. It's this very everyday sort of thing that's going on that then that's, it's the mundane that becomes the twist. That's what elevates it to this, this level of, for me, a sense of horror, even if it doesn't fit specifically within the genre there. That's what makes it so unsettling, is that it's just people. It's just people like me and like you who all of a sudden we find are capable of truly terrible things. Was that something that came up in her other work as well? Is that something she was especially interested in?
You know, I think with the short stories, because the kind of short story that she wrote often had this sort of weird, I don't want to even say necessarily a twist, but like, you know, the whole time you're reading Ordinary Day with Peanuts, this is not going to be a story about just how nice this guy is, you know, you're just waiting for something creepy to occur or something, or him to be proven. Like, I mean, the mentioning of the peanuts, you know, you think, oh, maybe all those peanuts he's giving people are poisoned or something. So I think that, you know, if you look at her longer fiction, it's less like, her longer fiction is a lot more about people who are sort of psychologically disintegrating in one way or another. And I think that interested her a lot more. Very isolated women who have kind of morbid tendencies and strong yearnings, but no outlet for them, and identity issues.
Well, both of those, I hate to pin this on her husband, because I know that she is a complicated woman on her own right, but it seems that she had a very difficult relationship with Stanley. How did that manifest in her work?
Well, I don't know if anybody here has seen this movie that I think you can see on Hulu called Shirley, that's supposed to be about her life. It has Elizabeth Moss playing her. It's not a very accurate representation of her life. It's based on a novel. It's almost like a form of fan fiction by someone who, you know, has this fantasy about, what if I met Shirley Jackson, you know, when I was like a young faculty wife or something. But it was a unusual marriage in that, you know, Bennington was sort of famous for the professor. It was an all women's college, and it was sort of famous for the professor sleeping with the students. It was just like taken for granted. Many people who went to school there during that period were just like, oh yeah, that was like one of the perks of being an instructor there, if you were male, was that you would sleep with all of these co-eds. So she didn't like that very much. And Stanley did do that. You know, he was unfaithful to her with these students. I don't think that any of them meant that much to him. I think he did love Shirley. She was not the easiest person to be with either. And she had a real edge to her. And she was not always that psychologically stable. Like, she had a whole period of agoraphobia, but it's hard. These two things interlocked. But the other thing about Stanley is that he was her biggest fan and supporter in terms of her work. So, and that meant a lot to her, because she felt very insecure about it. And he was like a big time literary critic who thought she was a genius, you know, read everything she wrote and gave her notes, and she used them, and, you know, she trusted him in that implicitly. So it was a complicated relationship. It was not just like she was married to this bastard who just cheated on her and treated her like shit. He saw part of his role in the marriage supporting her as a writer, but at the same time, he was also just a kind of super entitled mid 20th century American man who also thought that he didn't need to do a single thing around the house at all. So, and she was bringing a lot of money, especially with those humorous essays. I mean, she was supporting the family, and not entirely, but significantly, but still, she, you know, did all the cooking and the cleaning and everything, you know. And he was, you know, his mother, he had a Jewish mother, she spoiled him. And he just didn't know anything else.
I read, I think it was in one, maybe it was in the New York Times piece that we read, or maybe the New Yorker, I'm not sure, but she talked about leaving him. Did she end up leaving him, or did they stay together?
Oh, no, they were together. I don't really think she could have. I mean, she might have threatened to at certain points in time, but I think she did feel artistically dependent on him.
Given the time, I mean, she's writing in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Well, let's see. She passed away in what year?
She died in the 60s. Yes.
She died in the 60s. I mean, this was a big time for early feminists. Would she have fit in that group? Would she have, as a feminist in that era, what was her standing?
I think she really died before the feminist movement got off the ground. I mean, she was really a product of that, the exact middle of the 20th century. So I don't think she ever questioned those roles. She wasn't really a political person, or an activist of any kind. You know, she was a very inward looking person, which you really feel with the novels. Like, they're all about these female characters who are trying to figure out who they are. They're almost pre-sexual in a way, like there's not a lot of sex in them, or the sense that sex is sort of driving the characters. It's almost as if they don't even know who they are enough to have desires. So that was really what she was thinking about. She wasn't, you know, the period of like fiction that confronted like the sort of 50s housewife mold, just we hadn't really started by the time she died. And I don't know that she was very proud of her housekeeping and especially her cooking. She was a good cook.
Do you think that her work that she did as a humorous, I don't know, sort of domestic writer to some, I don't know if that's the right term, did that give her a stand, kind of hurt her standing as a novelist in like upper literary circles? Or I'm not sure how she was viewed during that time. You said she sold well, but, and her husband was a champion of hers, but what was her standing within the literary world?
There were very few women who were just taken that seriously and as writers. And, you know, like some of them, like Catherine Ann Porter, like nobody even reads anymore. And they tended to be of this sort of genteel, upper class lady writer mode, you know, like not someone who was middle class like Shirley. No one would ever call her genteel. That was her mother's complaint about her. You know, she and Stanley were really good friends with Ralph Ellison and Howard Nemiroff and a bunch of other literary figures from that period. But it's really hard to get a handle on what her reputation was. I just think that unless someone like a woman writer was making a bid for a certain kind of seriousness, like sort of highbrow seriousness, it just wouldn't be in the running. But, you know, somewhere here up in my study, I have this copy of an Esquire magazine that was published in the early 60s that is about like the literary scene. And, you know, it's like this gigantic magazine because they were so big back then. It had has this crazy map on the inside of the Red Hot Center and all of these, and it puts all of these figures, some of whom are still alive, in this sort of map of the literary scene. And then there's this long piece by Norman Mailer called The Talent in the Room. And it's all like, who are the major writers that I am competing with? And every single one of them is a man. So so it's just not, it's less what genre she wrote in than just the fact that she was a woman that counted against her.
And yet we're seeing right now a renaissance of her work. In the past, seems like the past 10 years especially, there's been this real resurgence.
Yeah, well, I mean, what happened was, after she died, the genre community around fantastic literature, you know, not really science fiction, but fantasy and horror, really sustained her reputation for a long time. And there were the Shirley Jackson Awards, which are given out to sort of like horror, supernatural, or dark fantasy every year. obviously named after her. And so they, I think they kept really bad in the lottery, which, you know, like I when I was a kid, there was this short black and white film that they would show in the schools. There's this film adaptation of it. It's pretty upsetting. And they showed it to us when we were like in sixth grade or something. It was very, you know, nobody ever forgets that. And it was quite common. I keep meeting people who are about my age who saw that in school, who were shown that in school. So, you know, and it's a story that's often anthologized. So people would only know that. And then like people who are aficionados of ghost stories or what would become horror fiction were big fans of The Haunting of Hill House. I know Stephen King is. And so, so, you know, there were people who were sustaining her, but then a lot of literary authors, you know, became really interested in her and were writing about her and reviving her. And for me, when I was an editor at Salon, the novelist Jonathan Lethem was a huge fan of hers and wrote a long piece when the Just an Ordinary Day collection was published. He wrote like a long appreciation of her for us. So there were these sort of writers who were kind of right in between the literary and maybe the speculative genre in the late 90s and 2000s who really did a lot to revive her. So I think you mentioned Carmen Maria Machado, and you know, she's clearly very influenced by Shirley Jackson, and she comes out of that sort of more literary fantasy speculative world.
Jenny had a question. She said, I noticed that the little boy in Charles has the same name as her son. Was this piece a crossover with her column? Did it share any elements with those pieces?
It has some similarities. I mean, like the and I think it's actually sort of based on something that actually happened with her kid. I don't know if it went as far. I think she took like something like that, something that he did, and spun it out to this in this elaborate way. But yeah, it has some similarities, except that of course you don't realize just, you know, how barbed it is or how funny it is until you get to the very end. Whereas the humorous essays are more just sort of buoyant, you know, and kind of, I mean, they're just very fun. And they're basically like, here are the wacky things that go on in our house. And they're very witty and it's super entertaining. They're obviously written as pieces that they have to kind of grab you with what they're about from the very beginning, as opposed to Charles.
As I'm pulling up a couple of other questions, any thoughts or comments from any of you about either the three stories you read or just about Jackson in particular?
It kind of sounds like her columns were like a precursor to the mommy blogs that were so popular, like, yeah, you know, 11 years ago.
Yeah, I think that they were a precursor to that, but I think that it's also just this sort of weird literary tradition that came with magazines, because when I was a kid in the 60s, you know, a young kid, I would wander into this section of our public library that had all of these weird old books like The Egg and I and Cheaper by the Dozen. And they were just like these humorous family memoirs, and there were like a zillion of them. And most of them were pretty forgettable, but it was like a really popular type of humorous fiction that was very common in the 50s. And there was a memoir called My Sister Eileen, which was not exactly a family memoir, about two sisters living in Greenwich Village in the 50s. That was a similar kind of thing, you know, like a funny memoir that would have like these moments of truth in it, but it would not be the sort of heavy soul searching that we think of as being memoir material now. I mean, like David Sedaris is an example of how popular a comic essayist, a comic autobiographical essayist can be. And she focused on her family life, but that was like it was a genre back then. That was the genre, I think, probably if she belonged to one, she belonged to.
Well, it was also a place that as a woman, she could find success, right? I mean, yeah, this was a realm in which she was, quote unquote, allowed.
Yeah, well, also those magazines, they paid really well, like way more than better than magazines pay now. Sometimes even in actual numbers, not even accounting for inflation. Like I have a friend who did a lot of research about what people were being paid to write for magazines in the 60s. And she said, you know, it just makes you want to cry now because you'd be thrilled to get that much money now, you know? So yeah, those magazines had huge circulations and were really popular.
One of the things that you, by the way, that's so sad. I just have to say, if not accounting for inflation, people were getting paid more for writing in the 60s. That just...
Yeah. Well, the thing is there weren't mommy bloggers in the 60s. If you wanted to read those things, there was no place to read them for free. So
one of the things that you've talked about with her work is that it has a really claustrophobic feel, which I think is a good description of her work. What is she doing with that? What is she exploring something particularly with these like tight, airless worlds? Is this coming out of what she's experiencing herself? Do you have any sense of where that's coming from?
I don't think that their family life was tight and airless. You know, Stanley knew tons of interesting people, all kinds of brilliant writers were constantly coming through their house. They were famous for their parties. But I do think that... I do think that these issues of who am I or what my identity is or, of dissociated personalities, hauntings, that was just a lifelong theme for her. I think it probably just goes back to her relationship with her mother, you know, and her mother wanting her to be someone who she wasn't and who she could never be and having to fight to be who she was, but never... She never really was fully able to stand up to her mother. We've always lived in the castle. Like it's about two sisters who live with their uncle in this moldering old big family house on the hill in this town. And everyone in town hates them and thinks that they're crazy. So they hardly ever go out. And, you know, it's sort of, I don't want to spoil it, but there's just a lot of issues of like who did what and the tightness of the family unit and the threat of outsiders. And they're always like a small group of people knit very closely together, struggling for dominance. And I often think that sometimes they're all of the people in the story are just aspects of a single personality trying to figure out which is going to be the predominant personality.
And sense of identity and how you find that identity.
Yeah.
Stephanie, you said you're reading this right now. Anything? I have not read, I've actually never read her novels. I've only read her short stories. But Stephanie, anything you want to say particularly about We Have Always Lived in the Castle?
Yes. So I'm not reading it now. It was actually like last year or something, my book club read it, and it was absolutely fantastic. I didn't know what I was getting into when I read it, and it was just very strange and very unique. And like when our book club got together and had the discussion, there were just so many variations on like conversations about like, is this character a good character? Like, why are they doing, you know, this? And like, what does it all mean? And like the conversations we had around it were just really interesting and thought provoking. And I absolutely recommend the book to anybody who's interested.
Matt, you had a comment?
Yeah, The Haunting of Hill House, and We Have Always Lived in the Castle, they, just to what Laura was saying earlier, they really do feel like the same book to me in a lot of ways, right? People trapped in this claustrophobic, eerie house, and she's so good at setting settings, and making a location feel real. I think the first paragraph of The Haunting of Hill House is maybe the best paragraph in a work of fiction that have been written by an American. It's marvelous. I mean, it strikes me, you know, that we were talking a bit ago about how she still seems alive. You know, The Haunting of Hill House gets an adaptation every 20 years or so, and some of them are really good, and some of them, the one 20 years ago was terrible, with Catherine Zeta-Jones, of all people. But it does, I think, speak to the ways in which horror as a genre has evolved over the course of the United States. It's like every generation makes their own version of The Haunting of Hill House. It speaks to what horror means to us as a society in that particular time. And the most recent one from just a couple years ago on Netflix, I think, feels very contemporary. The same way the late 90s one felt very much like a late 90s kind of retelling of the story. And then the 60s one as well felt very much like, you know, a film of the early 50s and 60s. So it's become, I think, one of these kind of perennial American stories that is going to be retold over and over and over. And for that, I think it's her best book. And I think it may be her most enduring piece of work, even maybe more so than The Lottery.
Laura, do you see any reason for that? Was she getting at something when she wrote that it allows it to just keep coming up? Is it that it's just really good, or was she tapping into something that, like Matt says, is something perennial in our cultural psyche?
That's an interesting question. I mean, maybe because it at least when we have always lived in the castle, the house itself is not really haunted. You could say that the characters haunt that house, but I think it's sort of, it is like a classic haunted house story in that just how haunted the house is kind of a big question mark. You know, how much of what's happening is the result of the derangement of the main character, Eleanor, and how much of it is actually something malevolent in the house. And so, as Matt was saying, that needle, like where it comes, can change. Like the 60s one is you could almost really believe that it's really all just Eleanor, like all of the craziness is coming from Eleanor. And then the 90s one is just like insane special effects all over the place. I mean, in a way, it just reflects the market of horror films more than almost even the spirit of the age. And then this most recent adaptation, which has very little relationship to the novel, had turned the whole thing into this crazy family saga because it was series television, and that's the form, that's the prestige narrative form right now, is series television. And so how would you do that but if not to make it a family saga? Yeah, I mean, they're different ways that you can decide that someone is haunted. And it can be that they're simply the victim of a completely external malevolent force. And then there's the idea that some of it is coming from within them. And that is like, it's just a book where it's really hard to tell where that line is, which is the same with Turn of the Screw, that they're very similar in that respect. So it's flexible in a way, you know. Yeah. You pretty much know what happened by the end of We Have Always Lived in the Castle. You know what happened, whereas you never really know with Hill House.
That's interesting, because I don't know why I had this perception. I don't know if I was the only one, but somehow when I had heard of Shirley Jackson when I was younger, I always erroneously took her for sort of a YA novel. Kind of, I don't know why. Maybe because the covers of her books sort of looked YA, and, you know, in my young readership, that's what I thought. But it makes me think I read Turn of the Screw way too young and didn't get it, you know, like probably a lot of people. And it makes me think these are books that you probably do need a little more sophistication than to read. She was doing something more than what it might have looked like at first glance.
Yeah, I mean, mental illness was a big theme for her. And that's, to answer your question about the claustrophobia, it's pretty much all of her novels have that as a major element of the storyline, and the claustrophobia of mental illness.
Well, it's clear that's something that she herself experienced and felt and was trying to work through her work. Laura, any parting thoughts about Jackson for us?
You know, I think that Hill House and We Have Always Lived in the Castle are definitely books that it's worth rereading like every 5 or 10 years, because you just really see something different in them every time you go back. And I would just, they're short novels, so, you know, they're not especially demanding. And I also do think that if you are all caught up in the story of her life and her lack of complete happiness or satisfaction, come along with me. There's something about reading the beginning of a book that seems like it would have been so great, that is both sad and then also really heartening. If you'd like to think Shirley was getting to the point where she was not always going to be writing about morbid, sexually inhibited young women having nervous breakdowns.
Makes you sad. It's the book. It's been so nice to have her finish that off and get somewhere herself.
Yeah.
That's Christy Miners, executive producer of Radio West, along with Laura Miller, who is book and cultural critic for Slate.com. This is part of our Radio West Book Club meeting for August, where we talked about the life and the work of Shirley Jackson. If you're interested in becoming a member of the book club, go to our website, radiowest.org, for more information. We'd love to have you join us for September and October as we're going to read Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.